Lesson 54, The Mad Woman in the Attic, 19th Century Bills Coming Due.
In making the point in my last lecture that Bronte really wants to tell the story of the abused child, I don't want it to be thought that this is simply a kind of Freudian or psychoanalytic reading of the novel, even though you'll see there's going to be something of that. What I'm really trying to say is that art offers us a cultural script that is unique and that is privileged. It tells us things about the life and times of a particular moment or a society that we simply don't know how to get hold of elsewhere. They're not locked in any archives, the kind of information that comes out of this book, or I think that comes out of Great Expectations. That move from the country to the city, that sense of becoming a snob, but also the repressed rage that is in Dickens' book, those are very rich kinds of illumination, it seems to me, for what's happening in that society, the kinds of problems it is confronting or not confronting, the kinds of conflicts that make it up. And I think it's even more pointedly the case with Jane Eyre. I'd like to generalize, and I think that this can be borne out by what I've done with most of the texts in this course, by saying that art, good art, that we still read, is always conflicted. The book that is written that is unconflicted, the book that is absolutely straightforward and clear-cut, that has a kind of consistent picture of one set of values or one set of truths, those are precisely the books that die, that they may be bestsellers at the moment that they are published, but no one reads them later. They do not have the kind of resonance of great art. All of the texts that I've talked about in this course are sites of conflict. They're places where the culture speaks out loud. They're stereophonic in that sense, that the various voices come into interaction with each other. I think that this is a way that redeems art for as a study of history, but it's also, it should sensitize us into being better readers, into realizing that, good texts are very rich in just the way I've said, that they have high voices and low voices. They have straight voices and they have echoes. And those echoes sometimes come from the strangest places. That's why I also spoke to you about the notion of a character as being either the kind of unified, organic entity that we're used to, or perhaps something a bit more spread out, relational, environmental. What kind of a character would that be? And I said, to tell the woman's story in the 19th century, you'd almost have to have that notion of character. So I'd like now to begin putting these pieces together and return, as it were, to the scene of the crime, which is a moment at the beginning of this book where I think we really do see the sort of primal scene of abuse that Jane experiences. And that is the scene that takes place in what is called the Red Room. And I'd like to revisit that scene. You may remember that in that scene, Jane is locked in this red room because she has been squabbling with her very mean cousins. And I say she's been squabbling. They have been beating up on her, as is their wont. And in particular, her cousin John Reed actually throws something right at her head. And she goes after him like a tiger. She says she doesn't even know what she does to him. It's just a kind of animal response. And of course, Aunt Reed, who systematically tortures Jane, says this child must be sent immediately to the Red Room and locked in it. Now, you should know as well that the Red Room is the room that the uncle who is dead lived in. And even though he's a sympathetic character, it's still a haunted room. He's dead, but we hear that he was the one who had blood relation to Jane. That's the reason that Jane's been picked up by Aunt Reed. And it's not overdoing it to say that this room is, in a sense, the abode of the patriarch. This is the room that the male lived in, and he's dead now. And Jane is locked into that room, and she has something of a fit, something of a seizure. She sort of goes right off the edge as a child in that room. And after this seizure is over, the apothecary, Lloyd, comes in to help deal with her, to treat her. And the question he asks her, he looks her in the eye, and he says, "Who am I?" You can imagine that's the kind of question you'd ask someone if you thought maybe they had lost their senses. Who am I? Well, what I want to say is that that question, "Who am I?" is the central question of this book, not as it pertains to the apothecary Lloyd, but as it pertains to Jane Eyre, as it pertains to everything that I've been saying about what a self is, what a character is. Who am I? Do I remain I? Could I leave I? What does it mean when I leaves I? What do you think a seizure or a fit is? Jane herself uses the word that I was outside of myself, as the French say, hors de moi-même, outside of myself. All of that is what happens in the Red Room. Now, you remember Jane is put there because she has misbehaved in the eyes of her aunt. That's when her cousin calls her bad animal, bad animal. She is the house's bad animal, and she must be punished. So this is what she sees in this room. First of all, she sees a mirror, and I want you to hear the way Bronte describes it. Returning, I had to cross before the looking glass. She's terrified, of course, of being in this room because she thinks it's a haunted room. My fascinated glance involuntarily explored the depth it revealed, the depth of the mirror. The mirror is going to be presented to us as a kind of visionary place, a place that has depth, a place that has dimensionality, that has reaches. It is the place of virtual reality, as we would say today. It's the world of the reflection. My fascinated glance involuntarily explored the depth it revealed. All looked colder and darker in that visionary hollow than in reality. Bronte's making space here, is telling you that there is another world that's in the mirror that you see. And the strange little figure there, do you hear this sense of estrangement? The strange little figure, she's obviously looking at herself, but it's already sort of given to us as somebody else. And of course, is our reflection us? We know that right and left are altered in this, that, and the other. What is it that we see in the mirror? You cannot see yourself with your eyes. In other words, you can't look at yourself. You have to have a mirror that gives you that reflection. What is the status of that image? And the strange little figure there, gazing at me with a white face and arms specking the gloom, and glittering eyes of fear. I think of that passage in the beginning of Great Expectations, where finally we get this shivering, crying thing, which is Pip. And glittering eyes of fear, moving where all else was still, so that the glittering eyes of fear, her eyes, that she can only see by looking in the reflection, they alone move, everything else is dead, had the effect of a real spirit. It's as if she sees herself as a spirit. I thought it like one of the tiny phantoms, half fairy, half imp, Bessie's evening stories represented as coming out of lone ferny dells and moors and appearing before the eyes of belated travelers. We have here an introduction, it seems to me, to the spirits, to the imps, to the goblins. There's a sense in which she sees, and they're all versions of herself in this mirror. And then a little bit later is when the seizure comes. She thinks that she sees a light gleaming on the wall. Was it, I asked myself, a ray from the moon penetrating some aperture in the blind? It's not that. It moves. The light moves further. She's convinced that it is some kind of a ghost, perhaps. I thought the swift darting beam was a herald of some coming vision from another world. My heart beat thick. My head grew hot. A sound filled my ears, which I deemed the rushing of wings. Something seemed near me. I was oppressed, suffocated. Endurance broke down. She is visited by something. Now, we could say something emanates from her. This calls to mind for me one of the most famous paintings of the late 19th century, Edvard Munch's The Scream, where you have this figure that plugs up its ears and stares at you with these sort of vacuous eyes of terror. They're empty, but they're filled with terror. And the whole scene is convulsed in some sort of paroxystic motion there. It looks like a kind of apocalyptic scene, and you don't know whether the scream is coming from the creature and infecting the world, or rather coming from the world where the sky and the sea and the land are all interwoven in Munch's representation of it, coming from the world into the figure, even though it's trying to block its ears. What is terrifying about Munch's piece, and it's what's terrifying about this, is that that line, that skin, that demarcation, that membrane that is supposed to separate me from the world, that's what is collapsing here. That's what you just go right through when you have a seizure. That's what you go through when you enter the mirror. And so she hears something here, some coming vision. We see all of the affective components of it. Heart beat thick, head grew hot, sound filled my ears. A sound filled my ears. Everybody rushes into the room. What a dreadful noise, someone says. It went quite through me. That's why I referred to Monk. She has made this sound. She thinks it's coming from there. She is becoming alien unto herself, or let us say that something that is deep in her is beginning to acquire its own integrity, its own alterity. It's out there. This is the arrival of the demons, of the goblins, of the imps, the rushing wings that she hears. This is the primal event, it seems to me, of the novel. And all of the terms that are used in an affectionate, endearing way for Jane Eyre that Rochester used, my little imp, my little fairy, my little goblin, my little wren, all of them all of a sudden acquire a kind of demonic energy here. They have a kind of truth beyond what we could imagine. This is the invasion of the spirits, the body snatchers in some sense. And I'd like to suggest, and I'm sure you can see me leading to this, this is the other self. This is what cannot be accommodated in the social depiction of events. This is where Jane leaves her, who am I, is Lloyd's question. This is where the legendary creatures arrive. A scream goes through the house. This book tells us over and over about Jane's voice as a kind of scream, Jane's voice as having a kind of power. Something spoke out of me over which I had no control. And we hear that Aunt Reed looked at her as if she were a child or a fiend, perhaps, instead, when this voice goes through the house. Or the scene that I alluded to a moment ago in the last lecture, that when her soul began to expand and to exult as she speaks, I must speak, I must speak. Here's how it sounds afterwards. A ridge of lighted heath, alive, glancing, devouring, would have been a great emblem of my mind when I accused and menaced Mrs. Reed. That when she explodes into speech and tells off her aunt, the image that she gives us is a ridge of lighted heath. That ridge of lighted heath, that passion that is so hot, so incandescent, that it is imaged as fire, will become fire at the end of this book. The house will burn down. And it will be a very clear kind of logic to it. Her voice as the voice of a fiend. When Aunt Reed is dying, hundreds of pages later, and Jane goes back to see her, and it is a masterfully done scene. It's exactly what Dickens couldn't have done. In Dickens, it would have been drenched in tears. In this scene, there is no forgiveness. This aunt still hates her. And even though Jane goes back, Jane cannot find it in her heart to like the aunt. And the two hideous siblings, the cousins, are there, and Jane just does a number on them about how each of them has failed in her life. And of course, John, the one who taunted her the most, is in the worst shape of all. There's nothing tender about this. But when she sees Aunt Reed, who is dying, Aunt Reed says to her, I have had more trouble with that child, she's remembering Jane, than anyone would believe. With her incomprehensible disposition and her sudden fits of temper. Now, you have not read about Jane quite that way. This is why I said that it's an environmental text. It's a stereophonic text. We're learning about features of Jane that the Red Room sequence shows us. Jane, when she speaks to us, sounds like a fairly contained person. Sudden fits of temper and her continual unnatural watching of one's movements. I declare she talked to me once like something mad or a fiend. No child ever spoke or looked as she did. Well, the fiend is getting loose in this sequence. And I have tried to emphasize in talking about it the way in which the realm of spirit, the realm of emotion, the realm of rage, all of that is finding its own separate form here. It's experienced as a seizure, as she goes out, as she collapses, as others have to come in. And it is also experienced as an entry of these things, the rushing wings coming into her. If you can begin to imagine Jane as, in some sense, a multiple character, as a fractured character, as a character who leaves in this scene, then I think much becomes readable, much that is the most interesting. And that's why I've talked about character as not having to be something that is self-enclosed, but something that we might think of as relational or environmental, located in several different places. Where do you find me? Well, you might find me in your ears right now in some sense. You're going to find me on a television screen somewhere. I mean, where are people located? And it seems to me that this text is trying to get that across. Now, much attention conventionally is focused on Jane's relations with the two men of the text, and I've done that too, with the two strong men who are both bullies, Rochester first and then St. John Rivers. But for the remainder of this lecture, we're going to focus the attention on a different relationship, which is, I think, the most interesting relationship of this text. And it's between Jane and the figure whom I haven't even mentioned up to now, and that is Bertha Mason Rochester. She is the ghost in the house. She is the person who is kept in Bluebeard's castle. She is Rochester's wife, which is the reason that Rochester will not be allowed to marry Jane. And she's kept in the house, locked up in the third floor, because she is mad. She is the mad woman in the attic. That's the name of a very well-known book of feminist criticism. And it's called The Mad Woman in the Attic as a kind of title for the whole 19th century imagination. That where is the woman? She's the mad woman in the attic. This is what has happened to women. This is a script that no historian could possibly write. Only a novelist would take the liberty to state it the way she does. She is going to be the text's bad animal, not Jane. She is the monster in the labyrinth. And we hear her. I read you the passage where right after we heard, "Are there any ghosts in this house?" It looked to me like Bluebeard's castle. Then I heard a laughter. A strange laugh, formal and mirthless. And it's that laughter that is said to belong to a servant named Grace Poole. We're going to learn that that is the laughter of Bertha. Grace Poole is her keeper. We hear that laughter throughout this book, but we don't get close to her until she has bitten and clawed her brother, Mason, who comes to the house. And here's how we hear about her. "I heard thence a snarling, snatching sound, almost like a dog quarreling." And we also hear her in this way. "A sharp creak, a momentary renewal of the snarling canine noise, and a deep human groan." And then Mason comes out bleeding. "She bit me. She worried me like a tigress when Rochester got the knife from her. She sucked the blood," Mason says. "She said she'd drain my heart." So she's presented to us, even though we don't yet see her, as a very, very odious figure, as a purely animal type of figure. Canine, sucking blood, vampirish. She is the house's secret. She's Rochester's secret. We also see her. We finally see her when the wedding is prevented because someone comes forth to say, "He cannot, is there any reason why this marriage cannot take place?" And the answer is, yes, there is. He happens to have a wife who is still living. And Rochester, at this point, explodes, and he explains to the group why he has tried to marry Jane. "Bertha Mason is mad," he says, "and she came of a mad family, idiots and maniacs through three generations. Her mother, the Creole, was both a madwoman and a drunkard. This girl," and he points to Jane, "knew no more than you would," he's the person at the service, "of the disgusting secret. She thought all was fair and legal, and never dreamed she was going to be entrapped into a feigned union with a defrauded wretch, already bound to," and this is Rochester's description of his wife, "a bad, mad, and imbruted partner." They then take us on a tour into the Thornfield, up to the third floor, and we get our first look at this bad, mad, imbruted creature. This is how we get it. "In the deep shade at the farther end of the room, a figure ran backwards and forwards. What it was, whether beast or human being, one could not at first sight tell. It groveled seemingly on all fours. It snatched and growled like some strange wild animal, but it was covered with clothing and a quantity of dark, grizzled hair. Wild as a mane, it hid its face and head. The doubled hyena rose up and stood tall on its hind feet. The maniac bellowed. She parted her shaggy locks from her visage and gazed wildly at her visitors. I recognize well that purple face, those bloated features. We're going to see that Jane has seen her before. She's told that it was in a dream, but it wasn't. Then the lunatic sprang and grappled his throat viciously. The lunatic, the wife, jumps on Rochester and laid her teeth to his cheek. They struggled. She was a big woman in stature, almost equaling her husband, and he's very big and bull-chested. He's male power. And there's this woman almost as big as him, almost equaling her husband and corpulent besides. She showed virile force in the contest. The two of them are standing there, locked into a struggle with each other. More than once, she almost throttled him, athletic as he was. And then he binds her to a chair. Okay, you won't agree with me here, but I'm going to tell you what I think is going on in this scene. Obviously, this is the reason why the plot is what it is, but that's not the deeper purpose of this scene. I said in one of the earlier lectures, you've got to ask what kind of cultural work is being done by the writing. It's not the same as what Bronte wants to say. There's a logic that precedes Bronte's here. And the work that's being done here, that image of this creature, canine, covered with matted hair, large, corpulent, wrestling with Rochester, this woman locked up, mad, bad, and imbruted. This is a Victorian gentleman's nightmare about women. This is the worst possible thing that could happen to you, and let me be more specific. This is a nightmare about female sexuality. Her wrestling with him, standing there together, almost throttling him, is the deepest terror they can imagine. This is the animal, the bad animal of the text. It's about the bad animality that is part of the human enterprise. And it is kept locked up in a room, but you can't keep it locked up there. That's been the theme song of most of my lectures. You can't keep things locked up. Again, that's what the psychoanalysts have told us as well. Rochester refers to her as sexual nightmare, sexual excess, pure animality, bad, mad, and imbruted. And he explains that her mother was mad, and he explains all kinds of things. He was tricked into marrying her. He had no idea that she came from such an insane tradition, etc. He calls her at once intemperate and unchaste. He explains that, in a parenthesis, since the medical men had pronounced her mad, she had, of course, been shut up. There's not two sentences given to that. That's one in a parenthesis. Well, naturally, we lock her up. That's what you're supposed to do. The medical men said she's mad. Well, as I said, we've seen her earlier in this text. We see her because Jane sees her on the night before her marriage, when she's supposed to marry Rochester, or rather, when she's waiting for him to come back. She has a dream, first of all, of a child that is getting ready to die. And then she's telling Rochester this, that something comes into her room, a form emerged from the closet. And then her blood crept cold, she said, because she knew this was not Grace Poole. It seems her a woman tall and dark with thick and dark hair hanging down her back. And then she looks over, this is what Jane tells Rochester. Presently she took my veil. This is Jane's wedding veil. This is the veil she's going to wear as Jane Rochester. She took my veil from its place, she held it up, gazed at it long, and then she threw it over her own head and turned to the mirror. At that moment, I saw the reflection of the visage and features quite distinctly in the dark oblong glass. And how were they? Fearful and ghastly to me, sir. I never saw a face like it. It was a discolored face. It was a savage face. She says later, it was purple. The lips were swelled and dark. The brow furrowed. She calls it the vampire. What's going on in this passage? This we see even before we get to the interrupted wedding, and before we know we're looking at Bertha Mason Rochester. This is Mrs. Rochester. This is what Jane is on the threshold of becoming. This is Jane's wedding veil that Bertha takes for herself, and Bertha rips this veil in half. The traditional reading is that Bertha is Jane's enemy. Did you notice the passage that Jane has to look in the mirror to see Bertha's face? Whose face do you usually see when you look in the mirror? We've already had the mirror episode from the Red Room. This Bertha Mason Rochester is Jane Eyre's displaced rage. Bertha Mason Rochester, big, corpulent, is the alternative to the little wren-like Plain Jane. They are a couple, just like Jekyll and Hyde are a couple. This is a novel about paying bills that are overdue. It's about what happens to the story of the abused child. And so, in this passage, we see Bertha doing, just as I said Orlick in Great Expectations does, doing work that this text wants done. She rips up that veil because Jane isn't supposed to marry Rochester. She's working for Jane and not against Jane. Earlier in the text, she sets fire to Rochester in bed. That doesn't work. They save him. Jane saves him. Well, as you may know, at the end of this text, when Jane has left Thornfield, Bertha finally succeeds. Bertha finally succeeds, and she burns up Thornfield. And in burning Thornfield, Rochester tumbles off the terrace, off the balcony, and is both blinded and maimed. He loses both eyes, or one eye, and a finger. It looks like he might lose both. He is symbolically castrated. He is reckoned with. He gets his just deserts. And in that light, what I want to say is, if you look a second time at this book, the laughter, which we are told is Grace Poole's, and that we now know is instead Bertha Mason Rochester's, that laughter is, in some strange way, the text's response to Rochester's bullying. Every time Rochester toys with Jane and bullies, the next sentence or paragraph or chapter is going to start with laughter. It's the text getting even. This is why I said we have to learn how to read in an environmental way, in an ecological way. The text is showing us he's not going to get away with it. Rochester dresses up like a gypsy and taunts Jane. The next line is the laughter that comes out of nowhere. There are accounts being kept in this book. This is about writing a story that only art can write. No historian could tell it this way, because you couldn't see it like this. You have to be able to see that what's happening here and here are versions of the same thing, that this little wren-like repressed governess is in fact being completed, being expressed by this vicious, enraged, imprisoned woman. Bertha stalks back and forth in her cage, and it makes us realize that Jane Eyre stalks back and forth in this house. I told you, women need to have an avenue for their energies. And this text is about what happens when you try to lock them up, try to keep them locked up. So it's in that light that this text has a kind of cogency at the symbolic level that it is very easy to miss. But once you see it, it is hard to ever read the book the same way again. I said it is 19th century bills coming due. It seems to me it is the orphan's revenge. It's a story that we've seen in films like Carrie or Edward Scissorhands. There are lots of stories where we can see that when you punish people enough, something boomerangs. People who were marginalized get their revenge. There's a cultural script here. Jane herself, at the end of this novel, after having had her sort of possible seduction from St. John Rivers, finally returns to Rochester. She taunts him tit for tat. She talks about St. John Rivers as this handsome, which he is, Greek-looking man. And there's poor Rochester, got barely half an eye left and only one hand. He has to be led around. She's getting even for the Blanche Ingram stuff and for all the beatings that she took. So this book closes with a very, very famous line. Everybody who knows Jane Eyre knows it. Reader, I married him, is what Bronte writes. Reader, I married him. And what I've tried to do is to tell you a whole lot of things have to happen in this book and to Rochester before that line can be pronounced. He's got to be made marriable. He's got to be domesticated. Remember I said she is a culture heroine? She's going to take this savagery and turn it into form. This is a brutal version of those events. He's got to be prepared for this, and there is nothing very soft or sweet about it. So that you have the language of fairy tale often, and they end up living together happily ever after in the woods, but we have seen, I think, a story of extraordinary power, geared to power, about power, but written in the guise of a governess's education. Thank you.